Good morning, everyone. Good to see you all. It's a good day for this kind of thing, don't you think? I think weather like this lends itself kind of to introspection and contemplative practice. Of course, all weather does. So before we start, I have an impulse, which is maybe it would be nice to take a moment and just remember that we're home. This life, this planet, this reassuring gravity, the air coming in and the air going out, the carousel of sensations and memories, emotions, all the thoughts, the sound of the breeze, all of it's home. Right? Because we live here. This is where we live. So there's a safety in that. Even in the midst of affliction, if we're nervous about something, or we're fearful, or we're grieving, there's a familiarity to the landscape in which that's happening. The bones and the muscles and the way experience manifests to us when we're in form has a familiarity to it. We're used to this. So even when something difficult arises, it's not completely unknown. And somehow I feel like when we know we're at home, we're not as likely to be quite so knocked over, quite so thrown off by our experience. If I was to receive bad news, I'd rather be at home when I heard it. Because there's a safety, there's a contentment about being at home, and I like to remind myself, this is home. This is home. I'm a human animal, and this is Earth. So I'm never apart from that home. So maybe that's a good place to start today. I hope you feel at home, and I hope that your experience of home today contains some contentment, some okayness around how things are right now for you. Not a strong need for them to be different. Yeah. Okay, thank you. I'll give a talk now. I have nothing to say, but I'll give a talk. So what I am going to talk about today is a koan from the end of a fascicle by Dogen, an essay by Dogen, that some of you who are familiar with Zen literature, especially Soto Zen literature, will recognize and know. It's called Genjo Koan. It's quite well known. It's kind of Dogen 101, or the teachings of Dogen in a nutshell. In this case, the nutshell is maybe 10 or 12 pages long. And this koan comes at the very, very end. It's how he concludes this piece. And you have it on your programs, for those of you who have programs, so you can follow along. If you don't have a program, you can look on with your neighbor, or I'll just read it to you. And if you're new to Zen literature, especially koan literature, it might be helpful to say, don't try to figure it out. It isn't intended for your... It's not intended for your brain. It's intended for something else. So the koan goes like this. Zen master Boche of Mount Meiyu was fanning himself. A monk approached and said, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there is no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself?" "Although you understand that the nature of the wind is permanent," Boche replied, "you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere." "What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere?" asked the monk. The master just kept fanning himself. The monk bowed deeply. So that's our story today. What Dogen goes on to say about that, to conclude his piece, Genjo Koan, is the actualization of the Buddha Dharma, the vital path of its correct transmission, is like this. If you say that you do not need to fan yourself because the nature of the wind is permanent, and you can have wind without fanning, you will understand neither permanence nor the nature of the wind. The nature of wind is permanent. Because of that, the wind of the Buddha's house brings forth the gold of the earth and makes fragrant the cream of the long river. So I don't know that his commentary is any clearer than the koan itself, frankly. So if you're puzzled by that too, good. You're in good friendly company. So what I'm going to start with is a quick story about a spiritual direction client of mine, a directee, I guess. And I'm going to call her Dorothy. And right now, she's in the middle of helping her father to die. Her father's 93, and a few days ago had his pacemaker turned off. And they weren't sure if he was going to die instantly or if it would take a while. And he's still with us. This was about 3 or 4 days ago. So the place that Dorothy is a place we would all understand to be a tough place. A lot of suffering in that place. It's kind of a limbo space where she is. But this limbo space is very fertile. It's kind of pregnant in a way. Something's gestating in this space about to happen. And it's a very holy place. We don't use that word a lot in Zen. But it's good to remember that nothing holy also means everything's holy. So let's not get too hung up. And you know what I mean when I say that's a holy space, right? Helping somebody to die? Okay. So even if that word isn't your jam, you understand what I mean. It's a limbo space. So there's a famous dancer named Gabrielle Roth, and she said, "After you jump and before you land is God." After you jump and before you land is God. And my friend, this client of mine, is Christian. And she relates to those ideas. She was raised Catholic, so that's her inner kind of iconography. That's her inner spiritual landscape, are those stories and those images. And she relates to her experience of presence or the divine or awakening as wind. She loves the wind. She loves to be in the wind. I'm hearing kind of a breeze in the trees today. I'm thinking of her. Because she always experiences, because of her, just the way her life has unfolded, she experiences wind as supportive, embracing, sustaining. It's something dynamic, something she can't grasp, but that because of how her heart works, she experiences that as presence, like it's blowing on her, whispering on her, "I'm here, I'm here, I'm here." That's how the holy shows up for her, like it wraps itself around her. And she experiences wind as removing her burdens. When she goes out and sits in the wind, sits in nature, takes a walk, it's like everything that she's carrying with her that she's scared of is slowly but surely being blown away. Like it goes right through and it's blowing away her anxiety and her shame and her fear. So for her, it's a loving presence. And she wrote me an email last night that said, she's kind of keeping me posted on how her father's doing and how she's doing. No wind today. I'm feeling kind of stranded. That was her email. I know that feeling. I don't relate to wind in the same way she does. And I practice a different faith tradition than she does, but I sure know that feeling. That's a very human feeling. Feeling kind of stranded. And of course, her stranded feeling makes a lot of sense, considering where she is right now, which is what I reminded her of. Like, well, yeah, every day you drive to go be with your dad at hospice, you don't know if he'll be alive when you get there. You don't know how long that will last. You don't know if this is going to end in an hour. You don't know if this is going to end in 6 months. Of course you feel uncertain and frightened and stranded. That would make sense. You're trying to be present to the death of your dad, and that's a very tight spot to be. It's a very hot spot to be. That's how she experiences it. It's very hot. It's the opposite of wind. She experiences the space as still and claustrophobic and hot, which is why she likes to go outside and experience the movement and the freedom and the cool of the wind, right? So what I told her was that I was recently in Indonesia for a little under a month, I guess, 25-ish days, something like that, helping to lead a pilgrimage there for some folks. And the weather was between, for those of you who've been to Indonesia, you know this was new to me. And I'm a Minnesota guy, and I'm of Irish and German ancestry. So it gets above 80 degrees, and I'm officially uncomfortable. Right? Even 75, we could probably turn on the fans. That's just my biology, right? So when we were in Java and Bali, it was between 80 and 90 degrees 24/7, and the humidity was between 80 and 90% 24/7. So if you get up in the middle of the night and it's 3 in the morning and you go outside, it's like 80 degrees and about 80% humidity. You're like, ooh, this is the cool. And then the hot, when it's 3 in the afternoon, was, about 9. And so I was just like, are you kidding me? I really had a hard time. I found it just oppressive. So I was really identifying with this space that she was describing. And of course, she's describing a spiritual space, an emotional space, a psychological space, actually, of being tight and hot. And so what I told her was, when we got to Bali, we decided we would buy for all the pilgrims who were going to be with us, traveling for those 2 weeks, we'd get them a hand fan, one of these. Cost about $1.50. It's put together with a nail. Whoever built it probably took them 1.5 minutes. So it's just a hand fan, just a standard folding paper fan that you can buy. This one has cloth, but... So we all had one of these in our pockets, and I got really used to carrying this with me wherever I went. And I got so used to doing this fanning gesture that it became automatic, just muscle memory. You don't have to think about it. I'm talking to you as I'm fanning. It's not a thing. And so we would be this group of, there were almost 20 of us, 21 with the facilitators, all standing around with this automatic muscle movement. We all have our fans going. So what I liked, because of how she relates to comforting presence as wind, was the idea that she can carry around with her wind whenever she needs it by carrying around a paper fan. Even if she doesn't actually use it, the idea of having a paper fan or something like this in her pocket would remind her, you get to participate in presence, what she would call God. You get to participate in that. You don't have to wait for it to show up. You can actually help, right? You can participate. That's kind of cool, I thought. Because, of course, the wind is always present. We're sitting in the middle of it right now. The air in this room is pretty still. But, doors open in the front, doors open in the back. We're breathing in and out. There's movement always. What is wind but moving air? Well, that's what it does, so... The koan is right. The nature of the wind is permanent. It's always happening. And so we talk about fanning ourselves. Why do we need to fan ourselves if the nature of the wind is permanent? So to help her, I gave her the folding fan idea, and that was helpful for her. And I suggested to her that this movement, this automatic muscle movement, could be prayer. Why don't you store your prayer in your hand? And you don't have to worry about it having words. But it can be a way of participating. And you can just store the prayer there, and you can use it whenever you need it. So from the koan, Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there is no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself? So in our tradition, Soto Zen, this question is about the relationship between Buddha nature, enlightenment, awakening, whatever you want to call that, and practice. Right? So wind is Buddha nature, practice is fanning, in the simplest possible term. This is Dogen's great life koan. A lot of you know that. Those of you who know Dogen know this was the big question for him. I am told from all the literature in Buddhism, I am told from all the scriptures, I am told from the wisest teachers that my nature, my inherent nature is awakening. I am Buddha. I am enlightenment itself. That's what I am. That's an unassailable truth. Why do we have to sit zazen? Why? Like, why do we have to offer incense? Why do we have to do prostrations? Why do we have to sit zazen? Why do we have to follow the precepts? Why do we have to do anything? It's a really good question, isn't it? It's a really good question. Wow. That's a really good question. My client, of course, again, being from the Christian tradition, is actually no stranger to this same question because the same thing shows up in her tradition. God is everywhere, and he's nothing but love. So she's like, well, then why do I have to go to church? Why do I have to pray? Why do I have to, she's a meditator, why do I have to meditate? Why do I have to be kind to my neighbor? Like, what does this, why do I need to do something if the nature of this abiding awakening and goodness is permanent? Why do I need to participate? It's a really good question. So for Dogen, this was the driving force for him, and he spent a long time working on this. And he addressed this. He addresses this question in many ways in a lot of his writing. He's an incredibly prolific writer. And he comes back to this, and he comes back to this, and he comes back to this over and over and over and over. So that's what we're told. Even in 2016, as we're sitting here during the fall months in Minnesota at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, the core teaching is still the same. You are Buddha. You are awakening. That is your nature. That is the nature of reality itself. And yet, you guys know our schedule here. Every morning, 5:45, be on your cushion. Every night, 5:45, be on your cushion. We've got a service that follows the sittings. We've got a Dharma talk on Sunday. They're doing intro upstairs right now. You can meet with teachers. You can get a mentor. You can go on a retreat. You can take a class. Why do we do all this stuff? I mean, it'd be way easier, you guys, if we were all at home in bed right now. I'm only saying that because you're already here. It'd be just way too much work to leave. What a lovely question. I love that it's still alive, this ancient 800-year-old question from Eihei Dogen Zenji is absolutely alive in this room. You bet it's alive. What need is there for practice? What need is there for Buddhism? What is the nature of reality? Is it broken or is it perfect? Come on, man. Which is it? I mean, it's perfect, right? It's perfect. Everything's fine. Regardless of the faith tradition, the highest attainment, the highest scripture, the people who have gone the deepest into that tradition always say the same thing. They always look around and go, oh my God, it's right here. It's never been anything but this. It's absolutely perfect right now. It lacks nothing. We're absolutely participating in it. It's paradise. Ta-da! They all say it. They all say it. And then you kind of go, actually, hold on a minute, because I have unpaid water bills, and my kid's getting bullied at school, and I've got a divorce that's pending, or I'm turning off my dad's pacemaker, that does not feel like paradise. That feels like paradise is still waiting, maybe, for me. I have to do something more to get to it. Maybe when I resolve my issues, maybe when I'm 5 years into therapy, or I've done 400 hours of Sesshin and I have an enlightenment experience, or when I, whatever it is you want to plug into that hole, the thing that you think keeps you from it, that is the tension we're talking about. And I'm assuming that that's familiar to every one of us. I can't imagine it wouldn't be. You tell me that this is perfect, and yet I have this. You tell me this is paradise, and yet it's showing up right now as broken. It's showing up right now as frustrated or angry or bereft. Or her word, stranded. She feels stranded. Right? So, Although you understand that the nature of the wind is permanent, you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere. So what's happening in this little koan is we have a teacher and a student. That's usually the way koans work, or it's often the way koans work. His student is approaching him and asking a really clever and very good question. And notice you're fanning yourself there, Mr. Smarty Pants Zen Master. So if the nature of wind is everywhere, how come you're fanning? He's like, oh, yeah. I'm got him. Maybe if I get him, I'll get a promotion, or I won't have to sit so much, or he'll take me out of kitchen duty and give me something else, you know. I don't know what was on his mind. And maybe this was coming from a really deep place of suffering in his heart, too. I have no idea. We get to fill in this part about koans. We don't know. He is asking a very good question. But he is also starting by saying, here's the part I get, the nature of wind is permanent. Right? He's a smart enough monk, he's a clever enough student to know, here's the party line. I know what the teaching says, I'm Buddha. Okay, I get that. How come we have to practice? How come we got to practice if we're Buddha? So his teacher's good enough to know, oh yeah, you're good at quoting the party line. Well done you. But I can see you don't actually understand. I can see you don't actually understand that. And the reason I can tell you don't actually understand that is because I can see you're not at peace. Right? I can actually see there's still something there that isn't clicking for you. And the litmus in Buddhism always, 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 always is the transformation of suffering. The transformation of suffering. When you suffer less, you're doing something right. Right? I mean, if you've been sitting zazen every single day for 10 years and your life has not been changed in some ways, I offer the idea to you, you're doing it wrong. I offer the idea to you, perhaps you need a different practice. Perhaps you should come talk to one of the teachers here. Sit down with Ted for half an hour and he will straighten you up. Sorry, Ted. But you know what I mean? Like, this is supposed to be making your heart lighter. This is supposed to be making your heart lighter. And the funny thing about the way we relate to this stuff in Zen and the way we relate to this stuff in Buddhism in general is how we find lighter heart is by going into the suffering. It isn't about avoiding. It isn't about escaping. It isn't about running from. It isn't about denying, suppressing, all the kind of stuff we're good at, or distracting, or all that sort. No, no, no. Go into it. That's where you find abiding peace, inside of it. Suffering is not separate from your enlightenment. It's a very difficult teaching for us to get because we put it upstairs in the thing we call brain, and the brain goes click, 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 on, off, good, bad, suffering, joy, enlightenment, samsara, one or the other. Dogen smashes them together. He mushes them. He does what's called a smush. That's an ancient Zen term, the smush. He invents a term. I'm told he actually invented this from the kanji characters. He mushes them together. Practice enlightenment. It's no longer two ideas. That's one word. Practice enlightenment. Everybody who's read Dogen for even 5 minutes, practice enlightenment. Those are one thing. Those are one thing. So he recognizes, oh, okay, I get it. My student's coming to me and he's asking me about why do I need to fan if the nature of wind is permanent? Why do I need to keep sitting zazen at 5:45 in the morning if I'm already Buddha? Cool, okay, you're smart, but you don't still understand what fanning is. The good news about the student is that he's humble enough, he's wise enough to ask for clarity. He's smart enough to go, this is the part I don't get. This is the part I don't get. Good for him. Knowing what we don't know, that is huge. Please don't ever think you know, because you don't. And I know that for sure. Go try to give a Dharma talk. Everything contradicts itself. So the reason he's asking his teacher this, of course, why do you fan yourself, is because in the Soto Zen tradition, of course, this is an ancient story. This would have been, you know, I don't know, at least 800 years, if not 1,000 years ago, maybe more. The teacher in a dokusan, a formal interview setting, especially, is sitting there in full robes. He is Buddha. He is the embodiment of Buddha. That's what the tradition teaches you. This is Buddha. You're asking a question of Buddha. So bring the biggest, hardest, deepest, most painful, most challenging, whatever the biggest thing you got in your box is, bring that. Don't waste your time with anything else. Don't ask him for advice on what kind of car insurance to get. Go right in with the big one. Why do I still experience reality is divided when you're telling me it's not? Right? His teacher is supposed to know the answer to this. Why does an enlightened being still practice? You're sitting in front of me, Buddha. Why are you still practicing? Why do you get up and sit zazen with the rest of it at 5:45 in the morning? Why are you fanning? Why? It's a really good question. So why did Buddha practice after his awakening? He has this big enlightenment when he's 36. He dies when he's 80, whatever it was. Sat every day. Why did he keep practicing? He had already arrived. Weird, right? I mean, actually, that's really weird. My client said, how come Jesus prayed? He's God. I'm like, oh, I know that question. I know exactly that question. We have it in Zen, too. We call it, why do you practice after you're enlightened? If prayer is a means to connect to something and you already are that, why would you continue to do it? If sitting zazen is a means to get to a thing called enlightenment, once you're enlightened, why would you continue to do it? So what he's showing, what we're seeing here, is the mistake we all make. That's why I identify so closely with this koan. I really empathize with this student. Because of course I make that split. I do this to get that. I da-da-da-da to get da-da-da-da. I da-da-da to da-da-da-da. It's a transactional relationship with reality, and it's where I live 90% of the time. I sit so that I feel more whatever, and so the more whatever I feel, the better I know my sitting is doing. And if I've been sitting for this amount of time and that doesn't show up, da 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 da, I'm putting a quarter in the vending machine and I want my candy bar. Right? That's what I'm doing. I'm fanning so that I feel cool. It makes sense, right? It isn't that that's not true, it's just an incomplete truth. So, Dogen says that the way, meaning Buddhism, life, reality, the nature of the universe, is originally perfect and all-pervading. And when he says originally, he doesn't mean a long, long, long time ago. He means right now, before you even begin to start thinking about it. It's originally, fundamentally, unshakably, in its very DNA, so to speak. It is perfect and all-pervading. It is not contingent on practice and realization. He said, its perfection is not contingent on your practice or your realizing that. Whether you practice or not, whether you realize something or not, whether some big experience or not, does not affect the fact everything is perfect already. Abidingly so, eternally so. So he asks the question, why do we practice? Why do we practice? So what the student doesn't understand, what the teacher does a beautiful job of addressing here, is the student does not yet understand that all principles are interrelated. He understands the idea. He understands the principle, the teaching, that we are Buddha nature. He doesn't understand yet that all principles are interrelated and that his fanning relates to the movement, to the person, to the environment. That the effect of his fanning is infinite. That the ripples from his fanning do not stop with him. Your fanning is not just for you. Your fanning is not just for you. When I sit here and use this little fan, I'm moving all the air in the room. It's not just for me. I'm moving the air back there, too. It'll take a while, but I am. Everything's interrelated. The words that I chose to use this morning when I said goodbye to my wife, I don't remember what they were. They affected this moment. They affect 3 weeks from now, you picking up your kid at school. I'm part of that. The words you used when you left your house today, the TV show you chose to watch last night, how you worded that email will affect, it's affecting now. It's showing up now. It'll affect you 50 years from now. It'll affect somebody you've never met. It affects the air in the room. It's really hard for us to get this. It's very trippy. But we understand, on some level, we get, oh, I get it, interrelatedness. Buddhism always talks about this. Oh, yeah, interdependentness, interrelated. Everything affects everything else. Yeah. And then we immediately dumb it down and reduce it to objects and effects and causes and specific things. And because I'll release this, then it will drop, and the world of cause and effect is that simple and that straightforward. No. It's infinite. Infinite, meaning no boundary, no finiteness. So our fanning helps everybody. My fanning helps everybody in the room. My fanning changes the world. Your zazen changes the world. So the nature of your practice is permanent. Does that make sense? In a weird way? We would say, oh, the nature of enlightenment is permanent. Why do I need to practice? Oh, you practice so that you someday have an experience of in your enlightenment being permanent. And Dogen would say, no, your practice is permanent. It's permanent. What you have done there can't be undone. This is the activity of enlightenment. This is the activity of enlightenment. This is what enlightenment does. It only does it. Like love only does love. Hate only does hate. Enlightenment just does enlightenment. There is no place it does not reach. What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere? The student asks. And so the master's answer is just to keep fanning. Isn't that awesome? It's also very Zen, you know. It's very enigmatic and kind of quiet. And so we get to go, ooh, he's deep. Wow, what a good answer. My words are just going to further confuse the matter. Why did the Buddha keep practicing after he was enlightened? He just keeps practicing. Presence needs our effort. To be present in the moment includes your effort. It includes your inquiry. It includes your doubt. It includes your busy mind. It includes your crankiness. It includes your hope. It includes your wonderful contentment. To think that you're present just because you're present would be a mistake. You know, we've all been someplace that we weren't at. You know, you've all eaten a meal you didn't taste, right? Oh, yeah, I was there, but I was there. We had that whole conversation. Don't you remember what I said? Nah, I don't know. I wasn't there. I was sitting across from you for 2 hours, but I'll be darned. I was not there at all. Wow, presence involves our effort. Oh, I get it. It's abiding. It's always there. Of course, I was there. And at the same time, I needed to engage in activity. I needed to engage in effort. I needed to put my heart in it. We engage and we practice because the nature of enlightenment has engagement, the nature of enlightenment has effort, and the nature of enlightenment has actualization, that those are not separate. That's the part where we get hung up. That's where I got hung up. I didn't understand that practice was enlightenment. I really only could understand practice as a means to attain enlightenment. And so in my teachers, and all the wonderful people here who helped me said, your sitting is it. You're not on your way to get to it. You are it. You're sitting there. That's the activity of enlightenment itself. And then when Zazen's over and the bell rings, you're standing up is the nature of enlightenment itself. And you're leaving the Zendo is the nature of enlightenment itself. And you're beginning to fret about the business meeting you're on your way to. Hello, here it is. It's not later waiting to happen. Please quit dividing the moment. Very hard for us to touch it with our experience. So Dogen says, we don't need to practice in order to become enlightened. We need to practice because we're enlightened. Enlightened comes first. Suzuki Roshi says, very famously, everybody knows this one, you are perfect just the way you are, and you could use a little improvement. Those are not two different things. And our brains really want them to be different. Look, I'm either perfect or I'm imperfect. Answer me, weird bald man. And he's saying yes to the first one and yes to the second one. And what we want to do, and some of you have heard me say this before, and I apologize for my repetition, is say, oh, then one's 50% true, and the other one's 50% true. Right? One's half true and the other one's half true, and so put together it's true. No. The first part is 100% true. You're perfect the way you are. You're done. You're fully baked. You've arrived. Open the oven door and take you out. You're done. You're perfect. 100% true. What is also 100% true is, yeah, I can see you're still suffering. I can see that you're suffering. Let's work on that. Let's work on that. Let's transform that suffering. It isn't because you're imperfect and need to be fixed. But this is the nature of consciousness and form. This is enlightenment. Let's work on this. We work on this because we are this. It is wisdom that seeks wisdom, Suzuki always said. It's wisdom that seeks wisdom. I really want wisdom. That part of you, that's it. Right? Because ignorance doesn't seek wisdom. Isn't that interesting? That actually makes sense, doesn't it? Ignorance couldn't care less. Ignorance doesn't even know that it's ignorance. Ta-da! Wisdom is what looks for wisdom. Love is what wants to love. Enlightenment is what enlightens. That's how things work. Right? That's why peach seeds can only give peach trees. That's what they do. So, we practice because we're enlightened. Our awareness is so... We're so funny. Our awareness is so puzzling to me still. There's so much we think we get, but, you know, I mean, I grew this body. I grew this body. So did you. You grew your body, cell by cell. Well done, you. Do you remember that at all? Or did you have any idea what you were doing? Or no, not really. No. Kind of hard even to take credit for it, isn't it? It happened. One of the things that's woven in here, and I don't have time to even explore today, is the nature of self. Because one of the things that's implied and kind of hinted and teased at here is, what is the self that would become enlightened as opposed to the self that I'm seeing now that evidently is currently ignorant, I guess. The you that grew your body, you can take no credit for it. You don't remember it. You have no concept whatsoever how it is you heal over a cut. When you get a cut and that skin heals itself, you don't know how you did that. You've got literally no concept in your brain of how to do that, and yet you've done it 1,000 times effortlessly. Is that you? That's awakening. It's the nature of consciousness. That's what consciousness does when it's informed. Oh yeah, there's this thing, and I'm going to put some skin cells here, as opposed to foot cells or pancreas cells, because I know what the heck I'm doing. Wow, that's happening while I'm having a conversation with you about how am I going to pay the mortgage? Oh, my wife and I have been fighting. I don't know what's going on. God, ignorance is everywhere. In the meantime, there's a miracle happening on my arm. What's going on? Like, what is going on? Am I really that lost that I don't, like, no, this is dynamic functioning happen all in time, all the time, all the time, dynamic functioning. Wow, we're breathing as I'm talking. You're breathing as you're listening. You're at home. There's the gravity's pull on your bones. Can you feel it? You can hear, you're feeling, it's happening right now, the cloth against your skin. Are you somehow apart from that? But we can't quite claim it as ours either. Isn't that interesting? I don't know where I end. I really don't. I have no idea where I end. Couldn't tell you. Cool, huh? Isn't that cool? So Suzuki Roshi said, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There's only enlightened activity. There aren't enlightened people. There's enlightened activity. When love arises in your heart and you say something from that place, right? 10 minutes later, you'll be really cranky about something. So what's the deal? Are you enlightened and acting out of love, or are you just ignorant and you're acting out of fear? We want to do an either or. We want to do an either or. Which one am I? I'm an abiding thing. I'm an abiding thing. No, no, you're not. You're dynamic functioning. You are the nature of the wind. You are permanent. You are moving. This is the nature of how we really are. And I think, oh, there's an enlightened person called Buddha or Dogen or Tim or Ted or one of my good people that I hold inside my heart, my enlightened people that I carry around with me, my bodhisattvas. What would they do right now? They've arrived at a place called enlightenment. So therefore, right? They just have arrived. They're somehow static. They're somehow apart from the nature of the ever-changing universe. And everything they think, everything they say, everything will always be that thing, that they're somehow locked. I've kind of killed them when I've done that, haven't I? I do this all the time, you guys, but I've killed them. That's not the way this stuff shows up. We know this. Wind is the way this stuff shows up. Sometimes it moves slowly. Sometimes it moves fast. Sometimes it's warm. Sometimes it's cool. The nature of the wind is what's permanent. It moves. And it moves. And sometimes we see with great clarity. And we look so deeply into somebody, we see right past their defenses, right past their pain. And we just see how awake they are. And we fall in love with them. We see that light in their eyes and go, oh, I recognize me in you. I recognize you in me. We're awake. Wow. Wow, that's enlightened activity. That's the nature of enlightenment. And just like everybody else, I'll get triggered and cranky and something else will happen and I'll be like, argh. You were first in line. You're going to get more soup than I am. Oh, okay. Am I an enlightened being or am I an ignorant being? Who cares anymore? The question is practice. Practice. What's happening right now? What's happening right now? What's arising in me? This is the nature of awareness, to investigate, to see, to feel. That's what enlightenment does. It is awakening. That's what awakening does. It awakens. What does awareness do? It shines the light of itself on anything that happens to be there. This is the dynamic functioning of awareness. So whatever shows up, I see you. Hello, I see you. You bet I could use some improvement. And the part of me that recognizes that is the part of me that's perfect. And they're not two parts. They're not two parts. So Buddha nature includes our effort. If somebody asks you for the answer to this koan later, somebody sees this program like on your coffee table and goes, well, this is a really weird story. Where did you go this morning? You can make up a story about where you went. But if somebody says, oh, you could say, oh, this is a koan. You know, this is what I study. I'm deep. That would be impressive. And they would say, oh, what does this koan mean? You'd say, oh, well, the answer to the koan is that Buddha nature includes my effort. Fanning is the nature of enlightenment. Practice is the nature of enlightenment. They'll be like, wow, I don't understand it. And then you can pretend to understand it and feel super smug. But your responsibility, our responsibility collectively, is for our Buddha nature. We have responsibility for these bodies. We have responsibility for our Buddha nature. That's non-separateness. It isn't a thing apart from me that I can either do or not do, take responsibility for or not take responsibility for, engage with or not engagement. It's non-separate. My nature, the nature of awakening, is to care for it. That's what I do. That's why, like, if you're a parent, you've probably had the experience, if you've got a newborn, of being halfway down the hallway with a bottle in your hand before you wake up at 3 in the morning going, oh, right, yeah, because the kid has been crying for 2 minutes and you went to the kitchen and you grabbed it and then you started to wake up. You're already on your way to take care of the thing before you're consciously aware that you're on your way to take care of the thing. Right? They call that parent nature. Even if you're not a parent, you understand what I'm talking about. I moved to help before I understood, oh, there's a thing called suffering. I'm a separate being, so I better do something compassionate. No. Your deepest self, the nature of awareness itself, is you will reach out. Right? And if it's hard for you to imagine that in terms of somebody else, think of the last time you skinned your knee or you banged your foot against the coffee table and you went, oh, I. Your hand reached down and started to hold and care for the thing that hurt before you thought about it. Am I right? Of course it did. That's the nature of awakening. You did it automatically. Is there a you even there? I don't know. But the nature of awakening is to care for. This is, I'm going to move into the practice of enlightenment. I'm not going to do this as a means to an end. It's my nature. I'll do it first. Non-separateness. So Buddha nature doesn't happen because you have practice actualization. Practice and actualization happen because you have Buddha nature. And we call this in Soto Zen effort without desire. That's what Dogen called it. Effort without desire. Practice, which is not a means to an end, it's for the sake of practice. I practice to practice. And then that activity is what Dogen would call self-fulfilling. I'm not trying to get anything. I'm just sitting to sit. How do I fail? I can't. How do I succeed? I can't. Who cares? I'm beyond the split. I'm not doing this to get anything. I'm doing this. I'm just doing this. So, Zazen as Zazen, practice as practice, having no designs on becoming a Buddha, is what Dogen says in his instructions on, universal instructions on the practice of Zazen, or Fukan Zazengi. He says, have no designs on becoming a Buddha. Just sit, give your whole heart to it. Give your whole heart to it. That's enlightened activity. So to go back to our fan metaphor and then to wrap up, why do we fan ourselves? Well, we fan ourselves because, you fan yourself because you're a fan. You fan yourself because you're a fan. That's what you do. And when you fan the whole world. You fan all beings, sentient, insentient, past, present, future. That's what your practice does. The nature of practice is permanent. The nature of enlightenment is permanent. And when we say permanent, we don't mean non-changing. We mean always abiding, original, fundamental, primary. So we can't fail at it. The monk bowed deeply. That's the end of the story. The monk bows deeply. And it's a nice end, actually, because we kind of hope that he's not just bowing out of politeness, like, okay, well, I have no idea what you're talking about. You're clearly weird. I'm out of here. Which he could have, because you would bow at the end of Dokusan, and then you'd leave. That's what you would do. I like to think, that because he adds the word deeply, or whatever word he would have used that was translated into deeply, that the monk understood something here, that the student made a connection. And he went, oh, you just kept fanning. I get it, you old rascal. Okay, now I got it. Okay, cool. I'll play with this now. I'll go down to the Zendo and sit with that for a while. We like to assume he had some insight. But actually, whether he had insight into this or not, who cares? Because the bow is a perfect expression of that whole conversation they just had. Right? Bowing is a physical manifestation of our Buddha nature. It's a perfect expression of our Buddha nature. It's a central practice for us in Soto Zen. Gassho, we call it Gassho, the Japanese word for it, Gassho. Here's practice and here's enlightenment. They aren't two things. And they are and they aren't. And we put them together. Here's you and here's me. And we're separate, but we're not. And here's my perfectness that I know is there. And here's the fact I need improvement and I'm still in pain. And I can put them together. They aren't two things. My wonderful friend and her pain and her anguish and her uncertainty around the death of her father and the part of her that knows all shall be well. It always has been. It always will be. You can put those together. And she's doing that in the form of fanning herself. That's what she's doing. What a perfect expression. Understanding it doesn't matter. As long as there is true bowing, the Buddha way will not deteriorate. So the fruits of our practice come to all of us. They come to the whole world. And because of your practice, because of your true nature, the wind of the Buddha's house brings forth the gold of the earth and makes fragrant the cream of the long river. This very place is the lotus land. This very body is the Buddha. We are home. And vice versa, this very body is the lotus land, and this very place is the Buddha. So that's as much as I have to say today. I would encourage you to probably forget everything that I've just said. But please investigate this yourself. We all want to live a life of harmony and peace, and we want to feel at home, and we want to feel content, and we want to feel awake. It's a universal desire. And we only can find that through our own experience, so I encourage you to look deeply at this in your practice and see what shows up. See what shows up. And maybe buy a cheap hand fan. They're like $5 and they're fun to have around. Thank you. We got announcements and stuff, and I went long. We have a couple minutes, though. Does anybody have anything they'd like to throw out there? Questions, comments, offerings, anything that's alive in you that would make you feel better to offer? You hear the whistling on the porch? Isn't that awesome? Isn't that great? Please. Sure.
Moving through suffering, mm-hmm. in order to alleviate suffering.
Yeah. Sure. I'll be very brief because it's a great. Thank you. It's a lovely question. Yeah, and I'll stay close to the surface. So Buddhism's response to, it's been said, and I would agree, painting with a broad brush, the purpose of Buddhism is to transform human suffering, to transform it, to look at it and figure out what the roots are and how we stop doing it. Essentially, that's kind of what it's here to do, is transform the experience of suffering. And so we start that by looking really deeply at it, examining it very, very closely with both our mind, our heart, our awareness, our body. We go all the way into our investigation, so to speak, to figure out what it is that gives rise to that and to transform those seeds into seeds of joy, freedom, compassion, that kind of stuff. Am I close, you guys? Does that sound more or less like what you're used to? You're so polite for just nodding. It's nice. So the lady can go, what was he talking about? I'm so high. But the thing that's cool about that, and it took me a long time to get this because it's totally counterintuitive. I want to avoid the suffering in my life. I want to cut it off, suppress it, repress it, distract myself, deny it. I don't know. I want to go to, that's why I started coming to Zen Center. I want to go to a place called enlightenment because I'm suffering a lot. I don't want this. I want that. Right? Pretty human, makes perfect sense. If that's why you're here, good. It's a good reason to be here. But what Buddhism does that I always felt was kind of counterintuitive is they say, oh, I see that you're suffering. Let's look at that really carefully. Really carefully. Let's feel it very deeply. Let's go all the way in. So actually my example of the parent running down the hallway with the bottle in her hand is a perfect example. There's the sound of suffering. Suffering is arising in my life right now. Whether that's arriving in a baby or a friend of mine or the political arena or in my own heart, she is automatically, because this is the nature of awareness, she's moving toward it. She's going to pick that kid up. She's going to get closer to it. She's going to hold it in her arms, and she's going to start rocking before she even thinks, and she'll start asking questions. Hey, sweetie, what's the deal? Are you hungry? Do you got a poopy diaper? Do you just need some attention? She's going to get really close to it and pull it right up against her own body and start to rock it and ask questions. That's what Buddhists do with suffering. I see you, anger. Hey, sweetie, what's the deal? What happened? Are you scared? Did you get hurt? Okay. Right? It isn't like I'm going to amputate this, because no. And the funny thing is, we all have crying babies in our lives, and most of us, we just, let's add more doors between us and the baby so we don't hear it anymore. Or let's get in the car and drive away. Or let's turn up the stereo. We'll crank the stereo really loud and put on that weird, like, German death metal music, and we won't even hear the baby. And we do this all the time. Like, I'm just going to answer emails instead of paying attention to the fact I'm lonely right now. You know, and it will effectively distract me from lonely. Will it cure that? No. The disease is still completely unaddressed. I've addressed the symptoms. I've distracted myself. I had another beer. I had a piece of cake. But so it's counterintuitive, but Buddhism wants to go right in. Let's move closer to that. And really transform it. Am I answering your question? Yeah. It's a good question. Thank you. Yes, we've got about 30 seconds.
I heard about another way to eliminate suffering, and it's a lot quicker than going into it. And I don't know if it comes from Buddhism, but psychological suffering is psychological.
Yeah.
Like, in a person with the suffering, we suffer. So there is a story about the two arrows in Buddhism, that the monster gets hit with one arrow.
Oh, yes. Yes.
The first one is the actual suffering. Somebody dies. It's pain.
Yeah.
When you add to the story, that's your second arrow. You yourself are creating the story and going and going.
Yeah.
So it's a lot quicker. When you stop suffering, when you stop the story from your head.
Yeah. Very much so. That's exactly right. And that's the other thing that's a little counterintuitive about the Buddhist take on suffering is it's not out there. It's in here. It arises in this heart, in this mind. This is where, you know, pain can come from out there. I get that. But suffering, the part of me that wants it to be different, or explain it, or take care of it, or control it, can only arise from inside. So that's why the lens is always turned inward. Shine the light inward, Dogen always said. Turn it around. So yeah, that's a perfect example, the two arrows. So, Peter, you're off. Go.
All right.